Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, now in depth on fake news. This is the latest in our series about the media in the age of the Trump presidency. And although the concept of fake news sounds pretty straightforward, news that has no factual basis, I was surprised to learn in preparing for the show that it's more complicated than it seems. And here's why. Two recent academic studies, one from Stanford, the other from the University of British Columbia, found that both college and high school students were unable to tell legitimate news sites from fake news sites, and they believed false stories planted on fake news sites. So that tells me that many of us aren't being critical or thoughtful enough or getting enough help with the idea of how to discern fake news from real news. So today, how to arm yourself against fake news, and I'd like to hear from you. Do you pass along stories on Facebook or Twitter that have iffy sourcing or iffy credibility? How much time do you spend sharing news that fits your political belief? I also want to hear about your media dashboard. Do you put opposite sources in that don't agree with your own political leanings? So talk to me about how you operate on social media. Are you passing along stories where you haven't really thought much about the credibility or the sourcing? And then what's in your media dashboard? Are you reading? Are you absorbing information that comes from a news source or an information source that has a clear oppositional view of where your politics are? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guests for the conversation, Jeff Guo is a media reporter at Vox. He recently wrote for The Washington Post. And Jeff, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Elizabeth Jensen is with us. She's the ombudsman and public editor for National Public Radio. She's with us today from New York City. And Elizabeth, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Jeff, I have to go back, since you cover the media, to my conversation with Gary from the Gazette in Hillsborough.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Do you think he's got something when he talks about the media's martyrdom complex?
I think the most interesting thing that Gary said was when he was talking about the media's tone, right? And that really, it shows that a lot of how people feel about the media, a lot of this fake news complex is centered on emotion. And thinking about emotional responses to news is maybe the best way to analyze how this fake news spreads, why people keep believing it, why people love to read about it.
So would you build that out a little more, Jeff? What do you mean when you're kind of contrasting the content of the news with the emotional response? Why do we have to be interested in that?
The way that the media ecosystem works nowadays is that stuff that tends to go viral has to be sharp in some way. It has to be emotionally resonant. There was a great, I think it was Snopes did a great piece a couple of days ago looking at, on the liberal side, the kinds of stories that liberals, the fake news stories that liberals love to share. And it pointed out, for instance, there was that item about, do you remember when Trump, everybody was talking about how Trump was at this meeting with international leaders and he wasn't listening to the translation?
Yes.
But it turns out that he was listening to the translation. You just couldn't see it because he had the earbud in his other ear. Stuff like that, right? So that's like, that was not true. But that fact, and it was quickly corrected, I have to add, but that fact traveled so far and wide in liberal circles, and it was like the talk of Twitter for at least half a day. And that kind of shows you how fake news operates. It's about people who really dislike Trump, who see something that confirms their emotional response to Trump. They think he's not bright. They think he's rude, right? And so these are the kinds of things that implant themselves in people's minds and that tend to travel. And in our news ecosystem nowadays, where you know everything is more or less free and the stuff that travels on the internet doesn't necessarily have to be true. It just has to be interesting.
Yeah, Elizabeth, I think we're I feel like we're on target talking about the vehicle of social media when it comes to fake news, because without social media, it seems like we were in an era where it was very difficult for fake news to spread. Give me your insight on that.
Right. Well, fake news, I guess, goes back all the way to the Spanish-American War. There were, you know, newspapers at the time that were printing fake stories. But social media has definitely changed the game. It's very easy to quickly pass stories along. It takes a click of the button. You know, or I was guilty of this once. I think I read something on Twitter, went to a party, said something to someone, and I hadn't checked it out. So it's definitely made it a lot easier for stories to spread very quickly.
And yet, Elizabeth, I mean, just in the way you told that story, I don't know that the expectation that news consumers have to bear, well, you must go right to the source, that you must understand the roots of this story. That's a high expectation to put on average news consumers, isn't it? They're not doing the kind of work that we are.
Right, it is. But that is sort of the nature of Twitter, of Facebook, of social media. I do think that there is some personal responsibility component there. You know, you can either follow any source and go and check out all the backstories if you want, or you can follow trusted news sources. But if you're going to sort of follow a really wide feed, you need to sort of take a little bit of public responsibility and sort of check out what it is you're actually spreading and sharing.
Yeah, let me grab a call here from Tracy in Pine City. Tracy, you're a teacher, is that right?
Yeah, I was a former, I'm an editor at a newspaper now, but I was a former high school English teacher at a private school.
Good to have your call. What are you thinking about?
Well, as teacher, I taught media literacy, and that's a state standard as part of the Minnesota Language Arts standard. And as part of that, you teach the kids to determine the credibility of sources and the author bias and author's purpose, and I had the flexibility to teach that in the private school, but I think in the public schools that standard gets missed because teachers are teaching to the test and trying to get kids to pass the MCAs and focusing on the other more important standards.
Yeah. So I think you've got something here, Tracy, that I want to take back to Jeff. Does some of this just come down to learning how to think critically about the media and the kind of training we're not getting in school?
I feel I'm very conflicted about this because on one hand, I think it's very important for people to understand all that the media does when they report on a story. There's a lot of talk about the media using anonymous sources. The president calls them fake sources. But, you know, maybe the media doesn't do a good enough job of explaining to people what its processes are, how it tries to combat bias, how it tries to be fair to people. People don't get to see all of the stories that get killed by editors because they don't have enough sources. They don't have strong enough sourcing to go forward. So that's one part of it. But the other part of it also is that, you know, the media is a shortcut, right? I think it's a shortcut in terms of, you know, if by placing our trust in the media, we don't have to think about sourcing. We don't have to really think very hard or critically about how a story was gathered, and this is it kind of greases the wheels of democracy, right? If we can have these institutions that we trust that work hard to deliver us real news,
right,
it makes everything easier. And absent that, we're still going to have news. Facts are still going to happen, and people might report on fake news. People, might, you know, fake news might spread, but at the end of the day, it might take longer. The process might be more convoluted, but at the end of the day, the facts will come out. It's just a matter of how quickly and how smoothly they will.
Okay, let me take that to Elizabeth then, because Elizabeth, National Public Radio, again, the organization for which you're an ombudsman and public editor, I think would want to be one of those sources that Jeff is talking about, in that you can trust that we've done all of the due diligence that we can do, that we have professionals here with experience, and we have a checks and balance system here. I mean, do we even want to expect that the people that listen to Morning Edition in the morning have to ask themselves constantly through that broadcast, well, how do they know this and why do they know this? Is that the kind of critical thinking that's valuable when you're the kind of trusted source that NPR is?
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff talked about transparency. One of the things I like about NPR, and I don't speak for NPR, I speak for myself as the ombudsman, one of the things I like about them is they have the Code of Ethics, an ethics handbook that's posted online, and that could be used to judge all of NPR's reporting. So that's the standard by which the reporting gets done. That said, of course, I think journalists should always be very quick to say, this is how I know this information. There's a lot of talk about anonymous sources these days, of
course. Yes, we did a show on this, yeah.
Right, so one of the ways that those of us in the journalism business are starting to think about it maybe is to talk about, instead of talking about anonymous sources, but to talk about confidential sources. So I think some people don't realize that an anonymous source is not someone who just calls up and you, the reporter, don't know who that person is. You're taking, you know, information that you don't know this provenance.
Elizabeth, I have to tell you, that floored me when that came out during our Anonymous Sources show. Mm-hmm. Dana Priest was on, you know, writes for The Washington Post, and she said people believe that it's just a voice somewhere and you're just basically writing it down and publishing it.
Right.
I could not believe that people believed that.
Right, right.
But they do.
And so we need to talk about that, right?
Yes.
So we need to, that's exactly what Jeff was saying. We need to say, this is what we're doing. These are our standards. You know, anonymous sources are not anonymous to us. They're confidential. You know, if you use a confidential source on the air at NPR, you need to get that approved by an upper-level editor. So you can't just go on and say, you know, someone said this, someone said that.
Right.
We're not going to use their name. There's a process that reporters go through to transmit that information, and I think we do need to be clearer about that.
Jessica says on Twitter, I don't share anything but readily start dialogues in person with close family members who do share sketchy articles. Ivan says, I don't share much news these days. I read most sources, regardless of their bias, as long as their journalistic standards are high. And Jeff, here's a question off Twitter from Chrissy, who says, is there a difference between an oppositional voice and a ridiculous voice, Alex Jones and InfoWars, for example? Good question. What would you say?
I think that one thing that we have to deal with when we're talking about the modern media ecosystem is the wing of the entertainment wing, let's call them. And so I would, you know, put Alex Jones and a lot of other right-wing pundits on that side. I would put some of the late-night Fox News hosts on that side, and I would put some of the evening MSNBC hosts on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of their job, right, is to be entertaining. Part of their job is to help you understand the news, and part of their job is to help, you know, help you think through different kinds of arguments. And so I know people who watch Fox News who are, you know, who tell me that they're very liberal, but they watch it anyway because, A, they want to understand how other people think, and B, they want to think about whether or not their deeply held beliefs are vulnerable to criticism, whether or not they should, update some of their opinions. And so it's valuable, but it's, you know, sometimes it also goes too far.
Jeff, a caller here who I think is speaking to exactly what you've just described, a Robert in Mankato. Robert, is that how you think about it, only kind of the reverse?
I disagree with almost everything you guys say. You guys are the most biased people on the air. The only difference between you and that nutbag in Texas is you just do it with a softer voice.
Are you talking about public radio, though?
I'm talking about public radio
but
and all you people.
Robert,
on it.
You're listening. I mean, what's that about?
I listen to you in the same way that people do opposition research on an enemy of the state.
Okay. And get this, Robert, and you call, by the way. Do you know what the percentage is of people who listen and call? Robert, you are more engaged than you think
you
are.
Won't let me back on the air again.
No, of course we would. I wanted to hear what you had to say. Elizabeth,
I've never been let on the air twice with the same phone number in 10 years.
Well, here you are in this conversation, and I want to take what you've said pretty seriously. Elizabeth, to what Jeff is describing about this idea of adding voices, oppositional voices, to your media dashboard, I think this is pretty important.
I would agree. And there are the technology is changing enough that I think it's making it easier. So there was a lot of talk about Facebook during the election had been sort of had an algorithm that was feeding you stories that sort of enforced or reinforced your bias, whatever it was, or your world outlook. I think they've sort of tweaked the feed now that that's happening less. NPR has an app called NPR One.
Yeah, we contribute to that.
Mm-hmm, right. It feeds national and local stories in sort of a steady stream. And that's going to be suggesting pieces now. So if you listen to an interview with a Republican, it'll suggest perhaps an interview with a Democrat afterwards that you might want to listen to. So
yeah.
I think there are technological ways that news organizations are trying to broaden your horizon, if you will.
I'm going to make the argument here also for Real Clear Politics because it's a great aggregator of a lot of opinion on other sides and a lot of good journalism there. If you've just tuned into the conversation, we're kind of midway through our media series here this month, and we're talking about fake news. I promise to give you specifics about how to spot it, what to do about it, how to check in with yourself, by the way, also on some of that confirmation bias that might lead you to news sources with which you already agree. So as we talk about fake news, Jeff Guo is with us. He's a media reporter at Vox. Last time you heard him on the show, he was with The Washington Post, and Elizabeth Jensen is with us. She's the ombudsman and public editor for National Public Radio. Here's what I want to know. Do you pass along stories on Facebook or Twitter that have iffy sourcing and credibility? Do you think about the impact of that? How much time do you spend sharing news that fits your political beliefs? Now, by the way, that doesn't mean it's fake news, but it also adds to that overall media environment where real and credible news gets mixed into stuff that isn't. And social media is unfortunately a great vehicle for that. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. To Richard in St. Paul. Hey, Richard, hi. Hey, Richard, are you there? We might have lost him. Here's a question from Richard on Twitter, maybe the same Richard. He says, please discuss AM radio programs like Rush Limbaugh. And Jeff, this might come back to it's entertainment, it's a lot of editorializing, but with a big dollop of news of the day. Is this confusing, do you think, for news consumers?
I think that news consumers, in some sense, are more savvy than most people think.
Really?
I do think so. And I think that there's a misconception on the left sometimes that the people who listen to Rush, the people who listen to Hannity are drones or mindless drones just lapping up everything that these people say. And I think that news consumers are more they recognize that these shows are entertainment. I don't know of many people who only get their news from these late night talk shows. And I think it kind of clouds the conversation, because when we're talking about fake news, right, there's opinion. That's sometimes part of it. There's like actual fake news, like all of the Seth Rich conspiracy theories that John Hannity likes to talk about. That's like actually fake. And then there are other things like mistakes that reporters make, like when Zeke Emanuel at Time said that the Trump administration took away a bust of MLK from the Oval Office, and it turns out the bust was there or something or whatever, and that was a whole viral thing. And so I think that one challenge is when people use the term fake news, right? It basically means what you want it to mean.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and President Trump has been doing this too, as I pointed out to Gary in our interview at the beginning, that now he applies fake news to news he doesn't like. So, So Elizabeth, that gets pretty confusing to try to understand that. Here's my question to you. Are there giveaways in stories themselves or where they appear, Elizabeth, that should alert you to questions about the credibility? I want to talk about specific techniques about how to spot it when you see it or know it when you see it.
Right. You know, Facebook itself has a pretty good checklist for how to assess stories and their credibility that I've been sending folks to recently. Some of them are things like, you know, does this story make you laugh? You know, which sort of gets back to this issue of confirmation bias, right? You're looking for something that embarrasses the other side.
Right.
That perhaps maybe is a tip off that it's not a credible story. You can look at the URL, right? You can look at the source. So there are fake news stories that come from news sites that are sort of made to look just almost like a credible news site, but they add an extra word or they have a different domain name in the URL that is a tip-off that it's not from a legitimate news site.
And that's that research that I talked about from Stanford and the University of British Columbia, that's exactly what it was, Elizabeth. These journalism students could not even these news sites looked so real that they couldn't determine the site itself or the stories that were on these sites as being fake.
I mean, that's a pretty broad sort of societal problem, too. I got a letter the other day in the mail that was purportedly from my bank, and it wasn't. It was a complete, utter fraud that had been made to look, just made to look like my bank. So I do think this is a problem. I think, again, some of it goes back to personal responsibility. Folks really need to sort of take a story and assess it and say, you know, is this credible? Where are the sources? You can go to the original website if you want. Yes, it's a lot of work, but I think it's worth it.
Call here from Nicholas in South Minneapolis. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well. What are you thinking about this?
I was thinking about, just encouraging younger people like myself. I'm in my mid-20s, and I am definitely on the left, to reconsider their confirmation biases and what they post online, because I've been reviewing, kind of, as Facebook allows us to do, everything you've ever posted, and how often I've been guilty of confirming my own biases and just putting the mirror right up to myself on social media. And just to encourage people to expand your palate a bit and expand the kind of sources that you're exposed to.
Yeah. Not that sharing stuff that you think is valid and true, there's anything wrong with that. It's just checking in, right, on maybe the bubble that you're living in and then trying to influence other people within that bubble.
Absolutely. It's so easy to get trapped in that bubble and not even know you're in it.
All right. Good to have the call. Nicholas, thank you. Our conversation continues here. We'll get a look at the latest news with Phil Picardi. And the more of your calls and your questions as you think about the role you play in spreading fake news, do you have a hard time? Have you had this experience that we've been talking about? Do you have a hard time spotting it when you see it? And then I want to talk about some of this interesting research about the Shorenstein Center and political alliance and perception of fake news. So all that coming up on the other side to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. President Trump today criticized Democrats and a few Republicans over the failure of the Republican effort to write a new health care law. "We will return," Trump declared in an early morning tweet. The Republican effort to rewrite the Obama health care law collapsed Monday in the Senate when two more senators said they would not vote for it. Congressional Republicans may now vote on an outright repeal of Obamacare. House Republicans have unveiled a 10-year budget blueprint that would dramatically increase military spending. The GOP plan, authored by Budget Committee Chair Dianne Black, would also pave the way for overhauling the U.S. tax code this fall and would pair that effort with cuts to benefit programs such as food stamps. The Trump administration is slapping new sanctions on 18 Iranian individuals, groups, and networks over a non-nuclear behavior, such as support for ballistic missiles development. The move comes the day after the administration certified to Congress that Iran is technically complying with the nuclear deal and can continue getting nuclear sanctions relief. North Korea does not have the ability to strike the U.S. with any degree of accuracy. That's according to the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Paul Selva. He says North Korea's missiles have the range, but they do not have missile guidance capability needed to target those missiles. Selva is appearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee today. And federal records show former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert has been released from prison in Minnesota and transferred to a Chicago reentry facility. Hastert is nearing the end of a 15-month sentence for sexual abuse decades ago when he was a wrestling coach. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:43.
Garrison Keillor returns to the Minnesota State Fair Grandstand with a special broadcast performance of the Minnesota Show on Friday, September 1st at 7:45 p.m. Tickets and additional information can be found at prairiehome.org.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, I'll speak with an Australian journalist who is covering the shooting in South Minneapolis of a woman by Minneapolis police. Then new research on opioid addiction from Hazel and Betty Ford looks at problems like overprescribing painkillers, but also studies whether some people are more susceptible to addiction. We'll discuss all of that at 11.
For the last couple of weeks, the only way to get a ticket for our Talking Volume season, and man, they are flying out of here, was if you were a member of NPR or a subscriber to the Star Trib, or if you were buying the whole season. Guess what? Single show tickets on sale right now. You can get them at the Fitzgerald box office. You can be there with Amy Tan and Dan Brown and more great writers and me. I'll see you there.
Support for this program comes from Half Price Books, offering book lovers a broad selection of titles including new releases, bestsellers, collectibles, even textbooks. More at neighborhood stores or online at hpb.com.
Back to our conversation about fake news. Jeff Guo from Vox and Elizabeth Jensen, NPR's ombudsman, and to the phones here to David in Minneapolis. Hey, David, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I have two things. One is about my dashboard. I'm a conservative Republican. I have Drudge, Fox, NPR, BBC, and the AP. And I tried to look at all of those. I figure I'm getting a wide range of input. The second thing I wanted to say, and I've thought about this a lot, my wife is a travel nurse. We have been all over the country for the last 7 years, and I have to say that you, Kathy Werzer, and the other people who are producing the local shows here in Minnesota are the best in the country.
Wow.
David, thank you. I am really impressed with the stuff, and all of it NPR have the national shows, and they're all good. But you guys just do a bang-up job here compared to some of the other stuff I've been listening to. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, and that's enough. David, thank you. That's really kind. I appreciate it. A call here from Scott in Chanhassen. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Sherry.
Morning.
Say, I would slightly concur with the last gentleman in that NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, which I also listen to, are probably some of the most credible sources that are accessible by radio or by television here in the Midwest. But I think that NPR has tarnished its image in the last year and a half in that I watched the Aleppo thing, the carnage in Aleppo happen, and being a man with a Russian-born son, I have friends in Russia as well, and I thought that the vilification of one man, and no matter what you think about him, Vladimir Putin in particular, was a little bit off base, and the blaming, I think that there was a lot of blame laid on the Russians for the Aleppo issue and then the election issue. And, you know, frankly, I don't think NPR offers up Glenn Greenwald, the journalist Glenn Greenwald, who took the Snowden documents, or intellectuals like Noam Chomsky, very seriously. They're seen as somewhat traitors here because they actually argue points that are in between Trump and the left. And the left has been most vocal about Trump and his behavior.
Okay. And Scott, I think I have the essence of what you're saying here, and we do have a lot of people that want to get in here. Elizabeth, is there something you'd say about how NPR chooses its commentators or its broadcast sources that they're going to put into stories?
So, those are two a little bit different things. I think I've heard a fair number of interviews with a pretty wide range of perspectives when it comes to broadcast, you know, news sources, commentary. The caller is correct. I've written a couple of columns on this topic. Lately, there have been more conservative commentators on NPR than there have been liberal commentators. You can check out my columns on the Ombudsman page at NPR.org.
Good.
We have gotten a few listener and reader complaints about that.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, would you add something to that?
I think that the media ecosystem is maybe one way to think about what is fake news, how to think about news and how to spot biases. I think you were asking earlier about, you know, ways to be smarter about looking at the news, and I think one way is looking at the stories that outlets choose to cover. If there's one story about an issue, looking to other outlets to see how they cover it, to see whether or not they share the same sources. Sometimes one outlet will use the same, will credit another outlet, will just take that reporting and package it in a different way. And looking at how the information spreads among news producers, among stations like NPR and outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post, I think that's one way to think about how to consume news.
There's been some interesting research, some of which was just presented this morning on NPR. But I was reading research that says that even correcting misinformation does not influence the belief that people have in the original story. Jeff, have you seen this?
Yeah. And what it really speaks to is the power of trust and the power of relationships. And so I think, I don't know if it's the same research, but I know of other research that shows that the most important thing to change someone's mind, the most important factor is whether or not this person is connected in some way. So if it's a friend, if it's a family member, if it's a politician on, quote unquote, your side, if it's someone that you trust telling you something, if they're out there correcting fake news, if they're out there speaking, that helps a lot more than some fact checker somewhere saying no, no, no. It's an emotional response. Sometimes it's not very logical.
And this morning, Shankar Vedantam had a researcher on who was talking about why that emotional response is kind of evolutionary. She is Geeta Johar, and here's what she told Shankar about that.
To us, it seems like it's almost something that's evolutionary. It goes back to even herding behavior in animals. the fact that you feel safer in a crowd. And this feeling of safety actually leads to you lowering your guard. So merely feeling the presence of other people seems to make people fact check less and be less vigilant.
So if the herd's with us, we feel safe and we're not as likely to check in, right, to put a standard up against it. I was going to ask you, Elizabeth, the Shorenstein Center has been looking at this, and one of the things that they think might work, might help in trying to determine more fake news and get people, I guess, less interested in it, is to bring more conservatives into the discussion around research and misinformation in politics and news sourcing. Is that something that you think would be valuable? And it may, perhaps you have a perspective on why that isn't being done already.
I'm not familiar with that that research or that that study that they've done.
On the face of it, how does it sound?
Mm-hmm. In terms of bringing conservatives into the discussion?
Right.
But specifically about fake news, I don't know. I mean, I guess I really focus more on sort of going back to exactly what I've been talking about before, which is sort of this personal responsibility, right? Mm. So there are trusted news sources out there. You can sort of go through and figure it out. You can figure out if your news source has an ethics code. You can figure out if your news source has a clear corrections policy. If it has transparency as to who the funding is and transparency as to who leads this organization, that they do fact checking. At some point, I think we have to just say that consumers need to take responsibility for their own news sources and stick with the ones that they trust. There is some new research out there that says that consumers may not trust the media overall, but they actually trust the news sources that they use most often. So that goes back to the callers who were talking about how much they admire the work that you do at Minnesota Public Radio. Consumers need to sort of make decisions about their own feeds, if you will.
Yeah. Jeff, have we given some tools for that, and what else would you add to that?
Well, a lot of this goes back to the increasing political polarization that's happening in our society, right? And so on some level, we can't really blame the media for giving people what they want, for telling people what they want to hear. I think MSNBC has been trying in the past couple of months to hire more conservatives to develop a more balanced roster of pundits to commentate on the news. It's unclear if that strategy is going to succeed, because they've been getting their best ratings at night with Rachel Maddow, who's, very liberal and who seems to be getting a huge audience for broadcasting her opinion.
Hmm. Call here from Mark in Bemidji. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, on my dashboard, depends on what I'm driving. Obviously, I'm listening to you guys now, and
thank you.
Appreciate that. But when I'm driving my pickup, I listen to Rush, and then I also listen to Chicken Noodle News, or CNN, as is known, and also Rachel Maddow.
Wow.
Oh, and Fox News as well, of course, Hannity. So the reason is, and I guess the reason I do it is because not everyone has all the story. You have a different perspective, and I think when you have a different view from all points, you can get a better kind of collection of it. And you got to be a savvy these days, like you mentioned. I love what Shocker said about the herd mentality thing. It's like, yeah, I've been there. So,
wow, Mark, your dashboard's really impressive. Can I ask how you voted? I'm just curious about, out of all of this, where you end up.
I voted for Donald J. Trump, our president. So.
Okay. Huh. So, Jeff, this idea of combining a lot of different views, I think you ought to add international views on that. I think it's super important to have the international take on how people see America. I think that changes perspective pretty quickly. What's your thought on that?
I think that's important. There's a guy at Slate who does a really great job of writing stories about America as if it were a foreign correspondent about America. And you know that it's really funny. I think it's supposed to be humor, but it's also it makes you think a lot about you know norms about when you try to rise above the day-to-day partisan squabbles and you think about you know what is happening to the nation, you know, how, what kinds of political institutions are eroding, things like that. I think it gives you a very different perspective. But one thing I'd add to what Mark's saying is, I applaud you, Mark, for building such a varied diet and listening to it with an open mind, because I think that's the most important part, because I think there's other research that shows that when you are exposed to opposing points of view, the reason that it rebounds sometimes is because it kind of, when we hear something that is at odds with what we believe, sometimes it makes us work harder to defend ourselves.
Right.
And that's part of the problem with fake news, and that's why it's so hard to eradicate, is that, you know, we work very hard to defend ourselves when we feel like we're under threat.
Jeff, always, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for making time
for
to do this. I really appreciate it. So, Elizabeth, we've heard Jeff gave us Slate. I gave us Real Clear Politics. Is there one other site that you would recommend for getting this really varied media diet to push back against, you know, not being able to recognize fake news? What would you say?
That's interesting. There's not one that comes to my mind right now, but there's always NPR.org.
Okay.
Put in a shameless plug for NPR there. I do think they do a pretty good job of sort of teasing out all the various perspectives. Sometimes you have to look for it. You know, sometimes in my office we have a hard time sort of, you know, we have to show people where exactly to find all those stories. But if you do a search at the if you do a search at NPR.org, you can often come up with lots and lots of stories.
Elizabeth, a pleasure. Thank
Likewise.
You. Thanks so
Thank
much
you.
For being with us.
Happy
okay.
to be there.
So, Slate, Real Clear Politics, NPR.org. And you can tell me on Twitter about where you go to get a varied and an imaginative media diet. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. By the way, what is everybody listening to on the podcast right now? The Thread Book Hour. Wow, if you've missed it, get it. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.